We cannot erase our personal history or experiences, no matter how difficult they may be. But we can grow from them, embrace who we are, and forge our identities in a way that fosters cultural humility when working with populations of color. How do we build structures to help facilitate our evolving skill sets as mental health professionals? And more importantly, how do we listen to our clients and the community we serve, while also recognizing the importance of adapting evidence-based psychotherapies? Welcome to People of Color in Psychology, the show that explores mental health topics specific to culture, diversity, and communities of color. I am your host, Jack Tsen. Our guest today is Dr. Susan Chanderban. Dr. Chanderban is a licensed psychologist and owner of the group practice Chanderban Psychological Services in Laredo, Texas. She works with adolescents, adults, and couples, and has worked at university counseling centers, school districts, and outpatient mental health clinics. Dr. Chanderban delivers evidence-based psychotherapies such as cognitive processing therapy and prolonged exposure for PTSD, and is trained in the Gottman therapy and emotion-focused therapy for couples. Outside of her clinical practice, Dr. Chanderban has presented on multiple mental health topics such as teen mental health, coping with long-term stress during COVID-19 in the community, and taught in graduate programs in counseling and psychology. As a Guyanese Canadian who has worked with communities consisting of a variety of ethnic identities, Dr. Chanderban will be discussing how she has continued to learn and adapt evidence-based treatments in a culturally responsive way. Dr. Chanderban, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, I'm excited to be here today with you, Jack.
Yeah.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You bet. Can you walk us through your journey and any memorable events or circumstances that may have influenced how you got into this work?
Yeah, that's a big question. I've thought about that, like why psychology? And, you know, I can say that I do love people and I love listening to people's stories. But I think deeper than that for me is, you know, I grew up in Guyana, and in my family went through a lot of struggles and there was political turmoil in the country, and that impacted my family and individuals in my family. So I think there was a lot of trauma in the wider society that impacted. And then also there was the experience of migration, my family having to come to the United States and Canada and start over and build new lives, and seeing how that was for us and learn about new cultures. And I think there's something about that experience that really fascinated me at looking at, you know, even just within my own family of origin, like different responses to really wider cultural events, sometimes traumatic events, how different people responded and reacted, sometimes in not so great ways, and sometimes in more resilient ways. And then also migration and that sort of adaptation and how that affected different people. And I think that probably is the thing that's always really fascinated me, looking at people, how they struggle and how they respond to struggle. And then I think the other piece is being able to help people maybe who are not responding well or are struggling to find more adaptive ways to cope. And I think that's really the thing that's drawn me to this work.
So early on, even growing up in Guyana, that you were exposed to a lot of traumatic events, but I don't know much of what was happening politically during that time. Can you share with me like what was going on around that time?
Yeah. So, you know, some of it is stories I heard that happened in Guyana in my family, and there were some conflicts between ethnic groups. And then during that time, there were safety issues. And then later on, when I was growing up, there were struggles politically where access to certain goods were cut off. I always think of Guyana in this way, that, you know, one day we got up and went to the market and eggs were now $1,000 a dozen, but no one's salaries had changed. And, you know, if you were sort of middle class, you could kind of maybe squeeze things out. But then the second stage of bad was you got up and went to the market and there was actually, you couldn't purchase anything. There was nothing to purchase. And I remember my sister traveling and having to buy food on the black market, which was illegal. And, you know, these things were occurring for a host of sort of like geopolitical reasons, you know, involving policies that affected the country in a certain way and certain decisions by the leadership. But the way it filtered down was us as a family having to deal with these things. So, yeah, it was a really interesting childhood.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, wow. It's as you're describing that, I'm just envisioning basically you didn't live in poverty, but it makes me think about that type of experience where there's so much mm-hmm. scarcity. And oh my gosh, I mean, $1,000 for a dozen eggs?
Yeah. And I'm kind of using that as a, you know, if I go back, I don't know that it was exactly that, but it was something like incredible jumps in price because of currency issues, but people's salaries didn't change. And so for us as a family, we were really fortunate that, you know, we never went hungry or we were okay. But as things progressively got worse, it was even difficult to buy things because of, you know, certain things weren't being imported. And then, yeah, it was definitely a really interesting time and lots of people trying to leave the country, whatever way they could. And it was a lot.
Wow. Wow. So also going through that and seeing the different responses to such a high stressful environment, and that in many ways carried these, or in many ways you carry these memories and helped you think about how that might apply in terms of human functioning and trying to help people cope with the stressors in their life, the traumatic events in their life.
Yes, exactly. And I think for me, like seeing those things when I grew up and then the experience of migration, having to learn a new culture, it's really been something for me working with different groups of people over time and watching things that they go through. And sometimes, yes, like you brought up poverty. Sometimes it is like something really concrete like that, you know, that, oh, they grew up with financial struggles maybe, or they're going through financial struggles. But then, you know, a lot of times it's people who, because of things like migration or immigrating to different countries, families being separated, having to learn different cultures. Maybe the parents speak one language, the kids don't speak a different language, or they have different levels of culture adaptation. I think my experiences have really helped me when I've worked with families going through just different transitions. Yeah, helped me kind of really understand that and be able to kind of really have that sense of empathy for it.
Yeah. This is like your superpower as you're talking about that. Be able to connect, right? Yeah.
I've never thought about it that way, but I feel blessed that I have been gifted with that understanding so that I'm able to kind of to see those things when they come up in clients' lives.
Yeah. To be able to help families walk through these challenges mm-hmm. and to have that experience and lens. Mm-hmm. So let's get into the work that you're doing. You're trained in the Gottman method, which I don't know too much about. Also emotion focused therapy, as well as just, you know, like for PTSD treatment, like prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy, which I'm more familiar with because I do that in my own work. Can you share with me, how would you apply those techniques in a way in which you've adapted it and maybe provide some context regarding the current population that you're working with, so our listeners can get an idea of, oh, here's our population, and how have you adapted the treatment?
So currently for me, I live in Laredo, Texas. It's a border community. And so the population is majority Mexican American. So my client load in private practice is majority Mexican American and drawn from this community, from a border community. And so in terms of adaptations, you know, I can think of one cognitive processing therapy case I had where, you know, this was somebody who came in with a specific index trauma in the present. But when we looked at their history and their childhood, they had a lot of trauma in migration and that thing of being separated from when they immigrated over because they were brought over as a child and being separated from a really loving grandparent they had never seen again and other family members. And because they were undocumented, they were not able actually to go back. And so I think that was interesting for me because they came in with this kind of index trauma in the present. And that was a pretty significant index trauma, the one in the present. but that in going back and taking that history, that they had all this other sort of, trauma of like the migration and separation. I thought that was really interesting, a CPT case, and differed from my other, other CPT cases I've done. So now,
may I ask the current index trauma, what was the one that was client presented with?
It was witnessing a violent event.
Okay.
Witnessing somebody who lost their life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So as you can see, that is different than the loss of the connection with the family member, the grandparents.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm.
So and he was focused on the index trauma, which was the current event, but just being mindful of that, this person had a lot of also past trauma of being kind of their sense of being ripped away and taken by parents to the new country and losing contact really abruptly with the other family and never being able to see them again because of their undocumented status. They can't travel back and forth, of course.
So given the knowledge that the client shared with you, this historical information, how did that change how you implemented CPT?
I think for me, so CPT is a pretty robust therapy. And one thing I like about it is that, so once you work on assimilated step points and you move on to accommodated step points, for me, with every client, I see a lot of generalization to the way they start to view other things. And so with that client, it was about using that thinking, that new thinking they were learning, right, about challenging cognitions, to also look back and start to challenge some of the cognitions about those other events, other prior things that they had seen. I know sometimes like you can think of it as, you can go through and do a separate course of CPT and separate traumas. But for me, with that particular client, it was about, we've learned these ways of thinking. Let's start to think about how we can expand them to these other things that you've experienced. And of course, other things that you may encounter in the future or are encountering.
To help them reprocess some of the historical trauma, to relearn and create a new narrative to that experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And do you have, just out of curiosity, do you have any examples for, say, the Gottman therapy or emotion-focused therapy for couples?
I find so Gottman, I will say I'm trained in Gottman therapy, and I will use some of the Gottman exercises with couples, but I do heavily for the last 2 years tend to use more emotion-focused couples therapy in my work. And what I love about EFT, and this is the thing, and I'd be so curious to hear the experiences of others about this, but what I find about it is because you are focusing on the idea of attachment and core emotional needs, that when you're working there, you're helping people learn to communicate in a different way. And so typically yes, people have this content they bring in. And I do observe, of course, because I think in the community I practice, people do tend to have really strong, close relationships with family and extended family. So sometimes maybe, conflicts about dealing with in-laws and extended family and couples trying to balance those things. It's more, but what I love about EFT is, you're really respectful of those differences that people bring in, but ultimately you're helping them to understand how those conflicts touch on deeper core attachment needs and help people speak from that place. And then in the later stage of the therapy, when they get to the point where they're talking through things and problem solving, I think they're in a much calmer place and able to talk about, resolving solutions with each other in a much calmer, more loving way. So I think of the example of a couple I worked with. It's been a while now. They actually were from two different backgrounds. One was Anglo, one was Mexican American. And there was a big conflict for the partner who is Mexican American wanting to give more financial help to the parents. And this was something they had really struggled with because the partner who is Anglo saw it as like, I don't see that as a responsibility of us. We should have more appropriate boundaries. They need to manage their money and do things in a certain way so that, And so being able to work through the stages of EFT and get to that point where they were able to work out a solution that worked for them. I think if I recall, it's been a while, the solution was that they came up with a certain kind of like a budget up to a certain amount, and then they would say, okay, that would be sort of the limit. And so the when partners need to really be there for family in that way, that felt honored. And then the other partner, like this idea of a boundary and, hey, we have our own goals, that felt like, oh, this isn't intruding too much. But I think, you know, because they were able to go through that first part of the therapy of learning to speak from a deeper place, those attachment needs, understand what things meant, I think it was easier for them to come up with that solution.
It's like when you're using EFT, that creates the foundation of understanding how we have unmet needs, and to create a platform and vocabulary to acknowledge these are the needs that were never met. And I would imagine that must have been very empowering for this couple. And to be able to also acknowledge that here's my needs, here are your needs. How do we both as a couple get both of those needs met?
Exactly. And what I loved about that was they came up with that solution themselves.
And thinking about also your ongoing work that you've described prior to our call, you mentioned how doing culturally responsive treatment is an ongoing learning process. Are there any recommendations you might give to folks who want to take this journey of truly honoring this idea of delivering culturally responsive treatment?
So I feel like I wish I was in a place I could say I could give recommendations, because that seems to me so much like a position of like authority and you know a lot. And honestly, I really think I'm like everybody else. I'm in a learning position, and particularly in my case where I serve a community, I don't have the same identity variables as this community. So I always feel that, you know, I'm approaching the community from a real learning place. And I think that's really helpful. And I'm so fortunate to serve a community too, where people here are so generous and so gracious that when I ask questions or I don't know something, they are so generous about sharing and telling me things. So those are my clients. I'm learning from them every day. And also my colleagues, I think that's been really helpful. So I guess if there's anything I would say, I think like having that openness and to learn. So with my clients and with my colleagues here I have several colleagues here in Laredo who are so amazing and so helpful that I'll reach out with a question, or I'm seeing this, or I'm not sure about this. And they are so thoughtful and generous about sharing their time and their perspective. And that is so helpful too. So I think, you know, I can share that from my own journey, that those two things, you know, have been really helpful. And, you know, when I've worked with other populations too, that are diverse, maybe in terms of religion, for example, that's something, reaching out to colleagues, talking with the client and reading on my own has been helpful for me.
Well, it speaks to the importance of surrounding yourself with colleagues, which, tell me a little bit more about your group practice.
Yeah, so we're a tiny practice, and our focus has really been on, okay, we want to bring really high quality mental health services to Laredo from, you know, there are other really good services here, but for us, this is what we want to put out, really high quality services. There's definitely a strong lean towards cognitive behavior therapy, empirically supported therapies. And one of the other clinicians is Jessica Resendez. She's an LPC, and she has a strong lean towards using cognitive behavior therapy in practice. And then Jacob Vasquez, and he is an LPCA, very close to becoming an LPC. And he also strong lean towards CBT, towards empirically supported therapies and ACT. And I think the commonality we all share is our commitment to bringing, again, those really high quality services to our community and really like examining ourselves. We meet monthly, we talk about cases, we, you know, talk about ourselves, our own reactions, what we bring culturally. And they're from this community. Well, Jessica is actually born and raised in Zapata. It's a small town neighboring, but she did her training here. But, you know, they are really good and we are really good. And I think we help each other grow and be open to, and we're really open to kind of looking at, you know, I would say they're really open to looking at the community, looking at what they bring, cultural messages, what clients bring in. So I really enjoy working with them.
Is there anything else you want to share about your practice or some of the work that you're doing?
I think just that we, you know, we're really privileged to serve the community that we serve, and we're really blessed to be here. And we think we're doing good work. We hope that's what we hear from folks, and we hope to continue providing those services. Mm.
And I noticed that you also work with adolescents. Have you noticed any trends or just observations in your practice in working with adolescent clients?
I mean, I think the pandemic definitely, and this is probably the case for everybody, it definitely feels like it, you know, for maybe people who were struggling with things like anxiety and depression before, it heightened struggles, or maybe they were doing better, but, you know, then things kind of worsened during the pandemic. Like I noticed with some of the teens I worked with, especially that part about staying home from school and, you know, the isolation, that seemed to really impact, especially the ones who were already struggling with anxiety and depression. Like I've noticed with some clients, like that's one of the things specifically we talked about. Like, yeah, it seemed like things got worse during the pandemic. Like that definitely I noticed. I also think a big thing I noticed, and this is for the teens and early 20s, but yeah, definitely teens, is like the social media and the information on there. Sometimes there's a lot of questioning about, well, maybe I have this disorder or that disorder, or maybe I'm bipolar, maybe I have borderline personality disorder, you know, because they're consuming a lot more information, I think, than adolescents I worked with from prior generations. So I think that's a really interesting dimension, that it seems like in a lot of ways they look into social media and use it to sort of like understand themselves and make sense of themselves.
So they're coming into therapy with these questions, and you as a professional helping them navigate what is actually relevant for them or what's correct factual information.
Yes. Yes, because obviously, yes, because for us as mental health professionals, as psychologists, well, those are diagnoses, right? So those are concrete things that have a reality to them. So yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I think in a generation where there is a sense of the privileging of the personal point of view and personal experiences, so finding a way to balance that and in a respectful way that is validating and maintains alliance. Yes.
So, Dr. Chanderban, as a woman of color, can you share with me some experiences that you've went through that were challenging and you overcame?
Yeah, I mean, I can think of in grad school for my thesis and my dissertation, the topics I chose to study, they were connected to identity variables of mine. For my thesis, I looked at West Indian parents and their involvement in their children's schooling. For my dissertation, Asian Indian mothers and cultural capital, their role in their children's schooling. And it definitely, those topics were really outside of what people in my department had previously studied. And so it was definitely, you know, kind of harder, and working with my committee to kind of think about how I was going to look at those questions, and even accessing literature at that time, it probably would be easier now. But so that was definitely harder. And I think, you know, that reflects like, you know, the way when things start to diversify, we bring new ways of looking, new populations we want to talk about into the mainstream. But it was a good experience because I think I had a lot of support. My advisor was really open and helpful, even though that was so outside of what had been done before and things that he had shared before. He was really open and helpful and supportive of me. And then committee members I had who were also really open and supportive and helpful of that. So I'm really grateful that, yeah, with their help, I was able to overcome those challenges.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing that. It's also speaks to the whole, I would say, theme being a person of color and an immigrant coming from a different vantage point and studying part of your identity, and how right, I don't know if right now we don't have a lot of literature about that, but it's like by studying something that is not the normative means you're charting a lot of new territories mm-hmm. and having to forge those new support systems.
Yes, yes, definitely. And it speaks, exactly. And it is hard. And sometimes you may think you may shy away from those topics. And it's good if you don't. And it's also so good when people who are more established, I think, you know, in structures, whether it be the academy or clinical practice, or who provide that mentorship and support, you know, who provide those things, I think that's so helpful. I can call out the names of the people, and I can think of Dr. Marfo, my Ghanaian professor, and Dr. Hines, my Jamaican professor, and Dr. Mike Curtis, my advisor. And I'm saying their names because I'm so grateful and appreciative, because I really was going outside of the mainstream, and they were really supportive, and I'm very blessed and grateful to have had them. So I think we need more folks like that who are willing to embrace and support those things.
So Dr. Chanderband, do you have any other final thoughts?
You know, I think it's definitely probably, I think America has really defined ways of understanding race and understanding identity. And those ways of understanding race and identity make a lot of sense given the history of the country. But sometimes as an immigrant coming here, you don't always fit that box. I don't. So sometimes that's been hard. Even, you know, in certain experiences, is particularly in training and grad school, I think it's really changed now and things are kind of much more open. So, but I think that's probably been hard to kind of sort of have my own identity and sort of not be boxed into something particular that really doesn't necessarily fit my experiences. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like here, and I say here, referencing the United States, it's like this category. If you are Black, Asian, white, Hispanic, you fit a box. But that's assuming that most folks are, for the most part, raised here. And so when you have folks, people of color, who immigrate from outside of the United States, it does create a whole different experience.
I mean, I think I'm really proud of our field, the way psychology has really grown. I've seen it happen since, you know, over the years, especially recently, in terms of really thinking more critically about providing appropriate services for culturally diverse populations, being more culturally responsive. And I'm really proud of us as a field, and I hope we continue growing in that direction.
I would totally agree with you on that. And Dr. Chanderband, how can we support you?
I think this opportunity to share and talk about me and my work has been a great opportunity, so I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right. Well, again, thank you so much for being on this podcast.
Yes. Thank you.
I hope you liked this episode. Please subscribe and share. We love to hear from you, so send me a message on LinkedIn or email. The People of Color in Psychology is brought to you by the Multicultural Counseling Institute, and I'm your host, Jack Sutton.